Quick warning before we get into the celebrations. There can be some swear words and adult concepts in these episodes, so make sure there's no kids around and maybe pop on some headphones. Rights for Women would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land upon which this podcast is recorded throughout Australia. We recognise their continuing connection to land, waters and culture. We recognise that sovereignty has never been ceded and pay respects to elders past, present and emerging.
Welcome to the Rights for Women Book Launch Podcast. I'm Pamela Cook, author, podcaster, and writing coach and mentor. My latest release, Cross My Heart, is a story about an orphan child, a lifelong friendship, and an impossible promise, now available at online retailers and through my website at pamelacook.com.au.
And I'm Kel from Rights for Women, the other half. I'm a podcaster and want-to-be author. My business is Listen Up Podcasting, and we make podcasts for a positive world, like this one. You can find me at www.listenuppodcasting.com.au or catch me on Facebook or Twitter.
As many of you will know, with the advent of coronavirus and lockdowns, authors with new releases have been unable to promote their books at live events. Here at Rights for Women, we want to help authors celebrate their new releases and help readers discover new books, all of which are available online, at retailers and through independent bookstores. We'll be releasing these mini-sode chats with authors regularly throughout the coming months while we're all in isolation and authors need a place to launch their books.
Please share the love by letting your reading friends know about the podcast and the books on social media and by reviewing any books you read to help authors get the word out. This is a great time to put some new books on your shelf, virtual and physical, and to share the gift of reading.
Hi, I'm Victoria Perman, and I'm here to talk about the women's pages. Just a little bit of a setup. My main character, Tilly Galloway, is a journalist on a Sydney newspaper, and when the war ends, 1945, she's sent back to the women's pages, much to her chagrin. She has been a war correspondent. But she heads back down to the women's pages and looks all around her and realises the kind of women she's going to be working with. And there's something really attractive and fun about these women. So I'll just set up a little bit of flavour about the characters in the women's newsroom and the women's pages. If the smell of woodbines drifted across the floor, it was Maggie, who smoked incessantly at her desk while she transcribed from her shorthand notes stories of the wartime crimes and misdemeanours of the populace of Sydney. Nothing seemed to faze Maggie. She didn't blink when covering bodies dragged out of the harbour, or backyard abortionists arrested after the death of a patient, or raids on upmarket gambling dens, or men arrested for willfully and obscenely exposing themselves in the public lavatory, often in the new men's toilets at Lang Park near Wynyard Station. If something smelt delicious, it was Vera, who'd been experimenting with another of the ration recipes she insisted her colleagues judge before she put them in her column. The best, by popular acclaim, had been meatloaf with boiled egg. The worst, by unanimous vote, was choco marmalade. With one taste, Tilly had vowed to never eat marmalade again until it was made from real fruit, even if it meant she would have to wait until the end of the war. The women of the Daily Herald worked at the oldest desks in the building and typed their copy on typewriters with the stiffest keys, which Maggie swore were as old as the paper itself, and ribbons that had been turned over so many times that if they were held up to the light, stories announcing the beginning of the war might be seen. They were surrounded by the detritus of life on a busy daily newspaper. Old reporters' notebooks, torn pages scattered near ashtrays and stained teacups and crushed cigarette packets. Wartime information booklets telling the women of Australia to eat more lamb, to do it for the boys, to make do and mend, reminding them that loose lips sink ships, to keep their legs closed and deny men regular intercourse to banish venereal disease, to refrain from drink in case it might lead to intercourse, to keep a clean home to ward off infection, to not be too nervy lest it affect your children, to get your share of air and sunshine. The men may have carried the major burden of fighting the war on foreign shores, but the women had carried their own burdens at home. There was nothing surer.
Oh, wow. There's so much in that short excerpt, Victoria. Thank you.
Thanks, Pam.
Lovely to be here.
Lovely to chat to you. And I'm thinking about that choco marmalade. How delicious that must have been.
Oh, I know. All the substitutes were, See, marmalade's one of my favourites, so I kind of always weave in things that are meaningful to me.
Yeah.
And the idea of substituting anything else for marmalade just was...
I'm a child of the 70s, and I clearly remember chocos at dinner. I think I'm still bearing the scars from that experience.
I'm a migrant kid, so I don't remember having them myself. I don't even kind of know. They're kind of an anonymous sort of pumpkin-y, bland something, aren't they?
They're just like mush. They're just watery mush, yeah. Mm. And I think my mum used to try and disguise them with like a cheese sauce or something, which, of course, covers any sin, really, doesn't it, a good cheese sauce. So anyway. But, it sounds like a fabulous book, and I'm really, really eager to read this one because I think it sounds like there's so much in there, and I know that you are very meticulous about your research. But before we get into talking about that, can we go back in time, take some time travel and go back to when you first started writing, how you got into writing and how you ended up being where you are now?
Well, I'd always wanted to be a writer. I mean, it was a dream I had when I was a teenager. I loved English. I loved books. And I used to create with my high school friend little stories. We used to type them up on our little typewriters and illustrate them and things and bind them. We were about 15. But it didn't seem like a real thing to me. It was as similar to me as if saying I wanted to be a princess or a rock star or something. So, that was just not in my world. So if you're good at English, back in my day, it was journalism or law. And I applied for law first and didn't get enough points in my year 12 to get into law, and that's really a blessing in disguise for the legal industry because I'm really no good at that really precise detail.
Yeah.
Funnily enough, now I need it for the books I write. But so I got into journalism and I studied that, and I worked at the ABC. I got a cadetship there and worked as a journalist for about 5 years. And then I went off, and ever since then, really, I've been a professional writer in all kinds of ways. As a media advisor, as a communications manager, all those sorts of things where you look at words and the meaning of words and how to communicate messages. But I never really kind of put away that dream of being an author. And I had a midlife crisis, that's what I would call it. I was about 45, and I'm 55 now. I was 45, and my youngest child was about 10, 11. I've got three sons with my husband. And it's at that age where they don't really need you as much. You know, they need to know you're in the house and sort of that dinner's being prepared and someone's doing the washing. My husband and I do share those chores. It's not a sexist thing to say. But they don't need you to be there right next to them. And so that gave me that time and space. And I thought it was finally probably time to try and see if I could achieve that dream that I'd always had. And coincidentally, at the time, a really good friend of mine got a job as the head of the SA Writers' Centre. I didn't really know of them before. So I went along to a couple of workshops and met romance writers, and that's what I wanted to write. I wanted to write things which I'd done serious jobs my whole life. And when I come home from work, I don't want to read something really heavy and dense, so I don't have the mental energy or the concentration, I guess, anymore. So I wanted something that was about real people and gave me a sense of hope and uplifting feeling at the end. And so I went to a romance writing workshop, and I heard about Romance Writers of Australia. And this was in February, and I knew they were having a conference in August, so I wrote every night, every day, and I finished my first manuscript. And I took it to that conference and pitched to Harlequin, and I got a three-book contract.
That's fantastic. That's amazing. I've never known. I've known you for a while now, and I never knew that story. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I have to pinch myself too, but brilliant. I do have to qualify that by saying that I really have exercised that writing muscle my whole working life.
not in
so
fiction.
So you weren't obviously coming to the fiction writing sort of cold. You know, you had a lot of writing experience behind you.
Yeah, and I think when you massage words and play with words every day, you kind of it's a thing. It's like anything, you know. I practiced. It wasn't as if I did something in my day job that was totally unrelated to that.
Yeah.
That's a story of how I got started. And that was 8 years ago.
And they were three romance novels, your first three books?
Yeah, they were, first three books. And I've been with Harlequin, now HarperCollins HQ, ever since. And then I've done some publishing with Thule Publishing as well, an American publisher who many Australians are up for. And so I've had 16 books published and I'm writing my 17th.
That's amazing. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, I can't quite believe it either when I say that out loud.
That's brilliant. So does the writing, the writing of the draft come fairly easily to you? You know, are you someone that sort of is able to get that first draft out pretty quickly?
I up until this book, I would have said yes. contemporaries, because I now write kind of historical fiction or women's fiction broadly, as it's, you know, the booksellers like to know where to put it on the shelves, and that's what I would see.
Yeah.
That takes a lot of backgrounding, a lot of research and reading. But when I write contemporary stories, they really flow because the settings are familiar to me, the kinds of characters are familiar to me, the things they might automatically do. I mean, you know, you can talk about a mobile phone conversation or sending someone an email or a message. Or, you know, when I'm writing World War II, well, then that's just impossible.
Yeah.
So there's a kind of a whole set of assumed knowledge that you that your readers bring to a contemporary book, which say it was like a shorthand. It saves you so much time. Mm-hmm. So I do find they flow better. Historical, and there's a battle in your head when you're writing something historical, even though mine aren't Regency, they're 1940s historical, as to how people spoke and acted and the things they did for leisure and what, you know, choco marmalade, what did they have for dinner?
Exactly.
The meatloaf with egg. All those recipes I got from magazines of the time, because I had that question in my head too. What did they have for dinner? Is it chops or... But there was pasta around in the war.
Okay.
Yeah. It was probably horrible.
Yeah.
Italians, of course, were making their own, but I mean, you know, sort of shop bought dried pasta. And, yeah. So
it would be a huge learning process for you just in doing the research. So how did you shift from sort of romance writing to historical?
My publishers encouraged me to think about doing something slightly bigger in scope. I kind of cut my teeth on five romance novels, which I still love them and people still message me saying they're just discovering them, which is fantastic. But they sort of encouraged me to go broader, and I'd always had in mind, I sort of straddled that gap a little bit with The Three Miss Allens, which was a time slip book about, three women in the 1920s in a seaside town, and then their granddaughters, great granddaughters, really, in modern day. And that was an experiment for me to see how I could marry those two time periods. And that went relatively well, and that gave me the kind of permission, or gave the publishers the confidence, I suppose, that I could try something a bit different. So I'd always wanted to investigate my mother's migrant story and people of her generation. And Mum was born in Europe and came to Australia in 1954 to a place called Bonegilla, between Albury and Wodonga. And I'd heard about that all my life, and I'd never really seen it in fiction. There are a few books, that's true. Bromulus, my father, was well-known literary book. So I wanted to sort of capture that migrant experience. And so I launched into that one, but with no expectations that it would perhaps be, you know, lead me off into a new direction. It was just something that you know, as you know, when we cast around for ideas in our heads, we pick it like magpies, aren't we?
Yeah.
Our birds. We pull an idea from here and here and see if we can make them work. And that one just worked. And I really loved that. And that took the sort of characters went through from the 50s to the 90s. And told the story of through three friends, four friends rather, of how Australia's changed. And that went well. And then I had another idea for a book about the Women's Land Army because I'd seen a reference to it somewhere. And then I wrote about that. So it's kind of, it's not really purposeful.
It's been a gradual progression really into that space. Yeah.
It's just stories that interest me, and I figure that if I am interested and I come across a fact and I say, well, I didn't know that, but readers might well do the same and think, I want to know about that. So that's sort of where I'm in the space I'm in now.
And you're very interested in women's lives and, you know, the generational thing, I know, as well, and how those lives have changed over time. So tell us about the women's pages, the brand new one.
Yeah, well, I am interested in women's stories, and I think, you know, we can't tell the whole story about our country unless we tell everyone's story. And that's not just women's stories, it's Indigenous stories and migrant stories, of course. But, you know, there's the saying that the victors write history, and men have written our history. Which means women have been written out of it. I wanted to put women back into the narrative of how this country was created and built. And I did that through that migrant experience in The Last of the Bonegilla Girls and in The Land Girls about the Women's Land Army. You know, all the women who served at home during the war, I hadn't really heard about them or read much about them. So after the Land Girls finishes on VP Day, August 15th, 1945, with a declaration of victory over in the Pacific, victory over Japan, and my Land Girls have to decide what comes next for them. Will they go back to their lives? Will they try something new, have their sweethearts and husbands returned? And that really made me think when I was looking around at ideas for the next book about what did happen to those women after the war. So that's what the women's page is about. It picks up on VP Day in another part of Sydney. My Land Girls are celebrating in one part, and my main character, Tilly Galloway, in the women's pages is a reporter on the Daily Herald, a newspaper I've made up. And she sent out into the streets to cover the victory.
Oh, fantastic. So you were going straight back into that celebration of victory that was happening. Pulling another character out. So what's the storyline? What sort of happens, not without obviously giving away spoilers, give us a few teasers, but what's the plot line for the women's pages?
Well, Tilly, as I mentioned, is a journalist on the newspaper. She started off as a secretary to the news editor, and during the war, when we see this in flashback, there are vacancies at the newspaper. One quarter of all male newspaper reporters went off to Europe and the Pacific to become war correspondents. So there were gaps in newsrooms, and of course there was lots of advertising, and they needed space to fill in between the advertising. And the news editors kind of looked around and looked for women who knew something about their newspaper. They didn't have much time to do anything else. So I have the news editor, who's Tilly's boss, sort of saying, oh, you'll do, okay, down to the women's pages for you, and she becomes a reporter. But the reason she wants to become a reporter is she wants to cover the war, because her husband has been missing for 3 years as a Japanese prisoner of war. And she wants to find him, and she wants to find out what happened to him. The last letter she received from him was saying, don't worry, I'm a prisoner of the Japanese in New Guinea, and I'm well, and they're treating us well. And that was it. And so for 3 years, she's not heard anything. But she's doing this job. Her best friend, Mary, who she shares a flat with in Potts Point, has a husband in Changi who returns home from the war. And he's a changed man too. And Tilly's life is in turmoil, really. Her husband, her best friend's husband, is living with them. She sees what the war has done to him. Her father's on strike down at the wharves. Sydney itself industrially was in turmoil. There were power blackouts in 1945. Electricity workers went on strike.
Okay.
The industrial unrest increased because workers had basically volunteered days of work and had foregone pay rises for the war effort. And when the war ended, there were wholesale attempts to cut their pay at the same time as the cost of living was going through the roof. So workers were very cranky and they weren't going to give up their chance to use their new leverage to try to better their lives and the lives of their families. So I wanted to contrast what the reality of all that with this idea we have that when the war was over, everyone came home and they went out to the suburbs.
And everything went back to normal and was lovely again.
That's right. Back to normal. It didn't ever go back to normal. Not for the men who returned and the women who returned, nor for the families, nor for the war widows who lost their husbands. Whose war widows' allowance was below the poverty line. It was really appalling.
Wow.
And women whose husbands had returned alive and had abandoned them as well. There was nothing for them. So it was this really. And in the midst of all this, Tilly doesn't know what's next for her. Is her husband coming home? There's a colleague in the newsroom who she starts to have feelings for, who's always been a friend to her. And this whole mix comes to a head.
Wow. And so it sounds like
I can't give anything away, spoilers.
No, please don't. Please do not. It sounds like from a writing perspective, you know, we love conflict. We love to write about internal conflict for our characters and external conflict. So it sounds like the perfect time period in a way for a story to be set, because you had all this social upheaval, even though the world would come to an end. As you say, there was still all this stuff going on. There was all these social conflicts going on. But then, of course, also the very personal stories of what happened to people, both women and men, who, as a result of the war, with all this sort of maelstrom of internal conflict as well.
Yes, that's certainly true. I found the period fascinating, and it really was a kind of mid-century turning point for a whole lot of people in Australia. You know, we do also have this assumption that, you know, as you said, people come back from the war, return to normal, and, you know, everyone went to the suburbs and had the baby boomer generation. But women, the numbers of women in the workforce actually increased during World War II and never dropped. They never returned to those pre-World War II levels. So, you know, working class women have always had to work. And they've done some of the lowest paid jobs in our community. But women got a taste of freedom of that work during the war, and they continued to work. And I met when I was touring with the Land Girls last year, I met a land girl. She was 92, Lil.
Oh,
she was
great.
And I asked her what she did after the war, and she said, oh, no, I didn't want to go back home. Life was much better on two wages.
Yeah.
Her husband had been away. That changed forever. And unfortunately, all the free childcare available during the war ended.
Yeah.
Because women should go back home.
That's right, yeah. So, yeah. Again, that conflict of situation.
Absolutely. So there was a lot going on, as you said, a lot going on personally, a lot going on economically and socially in the country. A time of great turmoil, actually.
Mm. So when you go to write, you know, are you someone that does a lot of research up front for your books, or do you sort of start with the characters, start with the story, and then research as you go? How do you marry those two things when you're writing a historical fiction?
A bit of both, because I don't want to go too far down a story path without knowing what actually happened, you know, the real-time facts about that situation. But I'm kind of all over the place, which does not make me happy at all. I wish I was a plotter.
You know
what it's like. We vaguely know where it's going to end up, but it's the getting there that makes it fun and interesting.
And if I was to plot out a book, I would get bored and just not finish. Yeah. So it's sort of about my process and my interest as well. But sometimes I'll find new and interesting things that will take the story in a completely different direction. And that I kind of think they're sort of serendipitous about, oh, thank God, that's fantastic. You know, if I find an interesting fact, I hope that it elicits that kind of reaction in a reader as well.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So I did look a bit of both. I will, in The Land Girls, for example, my character, Flora, leaves her city job and goes to work on a fruit block picking grapes. And I had her there on her first day and she's all keen and gung-ho, but she spent the day bending over picking grapes. And I thought, she would ache like buggery for someone who's been at a desk. And so I was sitting here at my desk thinking, look, if it was me now, I'd just heat the wheat bag up in the microwave, right?
Yeah.
From my aching back. But what did they do then? So were there hot water bottles in 1945? So then I went down that rabbit hole.
Okay.
Because I turned that into a gesture of kindness that someone brings her a hot water bottle. Yes, there were hot water bottles in there.
Okay.
But imagine if I'd written that and there weren't. Oh, someone would have told me and I would have felt.
Oh, you would have heard for sure. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I would have heard. Yeah. So I kind of do a bit of both. And sometimes I do it at the kind of final draft stage where I'm adding a bit of the texture and the layering to help create that sort of picture in reader's mind. So if it's the colour of, Tilly's lipstick, regimental red, which was a colour, which I thought was just a perfect colour back
then. Yeah, isn't it great?
What colour fabrics were available and what were the names of the shoes they wore and the descriptions, like were they brogues, were they court shoes, you know, just simple things like that.
It's been a pleasure talking to you about this book. It has been launched during COVID days. How has that been for you?
It's kind of weird, but I think it's weird for everyone this year. It was originally, the Women's Pages was originally scheduled for April release, but back then the whole country was in lockdown.
Yeah.
Really. So it was decided to push it back, and I'm really glad it was, because I've done three book events now, and they're the first events that libraries and bookstores have had since coronavirus hit.
Oh, so fantastic. Yeah.
It's wonderful, but it's September, you know, and this happened in March. So all I can do, it's like having a child and then when they leave home, Pam, that's what I think. It's you do your best, you make it, you know, you grow it up and then off it goes and it's out into world and send it out and off it goes. Bye.
And then get on with the next one, which I know you're doing.
Exactly.
Well, all the best with the book. It sounds wonderful. I can't wait to read it. And I just hope it goes, you know, really well for you.
Thanks, Pam. Thanks for having me. It's been a great conversation.
Lovely to chat.
Thank you for listening to The Book Launch and supporting our authors. If you like what you hear, check us out at writesforwomen.com, where you can find all our regular episodes and our new book launch episodes, and help us help authors by supporting us at Patreon for just a few dollars each month. You can find out more about all of this on our website.
And don't forget to subscribe to Writes for Women wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, can you please give us a quick rating and review so other people can find us and these awesome books that authors are launching in isolation right now.
Happy reading.
This podcast episode was recorded, produced and edited by Kel Butler from Listen Up Podcasting. Podcasts for a positive world.